Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning there, Marky.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing great. I have a new book that I've ordered. I don't quite have it yet. Sorry, we have a little microphone trouble here in the studio. I don't quite have it yet, but I've read all the reviews of it, and I'm very excited to get it. It's by a guy named Michael Pollan, who's a very intelligent food writer, who wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma, one of our favorite food books of the last several years. And he's come out with a new book called In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. And what he talks about is very commonsensical ways to eat well, and what's good about the way we produce.
Well,
food.
I've seen a couple of the ads for this book, and they're awesome. It's just first of all, if you don't know who Michael Pollan is, he's writing some very, very sensible writings, and you know, just the book, his last book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. Just in the title, you hear some of the things, some of the problems we have as omnivores. You're constantly being second-guessed. You're constantly second-guessing yourself as to what you should eat and what you shouldn't eat.
Well, and, you know, there's a lot of information out there. There's a lot of good information. There's a lot of mediocre information. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of disinformation out there. And Michael Pollan really does break it down. And you know, if you listen to just discrete sources of information, you could be scared. Like, I can't buy anything. Is that sustainable? Is it natural? Is it local? What do I do? But I thought what was great, in one of the ads for the books, they have 12 rules that they call the Omnivore's Solution. And I think they're great. You want to talk about them?
Yeah, of course.
All right. One is, don't eat anything your grandmother wouldn't recognize as food.
I think that's safe to say.
I'm in.
There's a whole slew of candies out there that grandma wouldn't have approved of.
There's a whole slew of entrees out there that grandma wouldn't know what it is. Rule number two, avoid foods containing ingredients you can't pronounce.
Yes.
Read the ingredient list. And actually, you know, we had somebody on the show once who said, I avoid foods that have an ingredient list. This is an apple. I will eat that. This apple contains 100% apple.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But if you must have foods with an ingredient list, avoid foods containing ingredients you can't pronounce. Don't eat anything that won't eventually rot.
Yeah, hard to digest those things, I think. If
the
plastic foods of America, it's a new society. I don't know if you're aware of that.
After the Holocaust, we're left with the cockroach, and the cockroaches will be able to eat the Twinkies because they'll also be left.
So, well, except they'll be in that plastic wrapper. They won't be able to get in there.
Do you know that we opened up in a 1990s? My dad served in World War II, right? And we opened up in the 1990s. A can of sea rations he brought back from the Pacific from 1945.
Scary.
Yeah, it didn't last that long. It didn't last the whole time. Sealed in a metal can. Very, very interesting. Okay. Four is avoid food products that carry health claims. I think that sometimes that's a good rule.
But I think that most of the time it's a good rule. If you're buying something that says on it, you know, zero trans fats, eat this food and, you know, your toenails will get hard. You know, it's.
I think you're stretching on that. but avoid food products that carry health claims. I think there are some food products that.
I'm not stretching that much. There are some ridiculous claims out there on our grocery shelves.
But there are some healthy foods out there that say it on the label. They want you to know that it's high in omega-3s or that it's, you know, it's olive oil. You may say high in omega-3s. Don't avoid olive oil just because it says that it's good for you. Shop. This is one that we see a lot.
Right.
A lot of people have this advice, and I think it says shop the peripheries of the supermarket. Stay out of the middle.
Yep.
And the reason is because the middle is all processed foods.
Mm-hmm.
And what's on the periphery? The dairy department, the deli department, you know, has some okay stuff in it, the produce department, and the meat department.
You know, one of the things
are on the outside, so shop that periphery.
One of the things that I've seen, and in one of my local supermarkets, they've put the organic / healthy foods in the middle aisle.
To draw people like
us in. So now and I'm sure that it's in defense of people shopping just like this, shopping around the outside of the supermarket, to pull them into one of the aisles, to kind of force that habit. So it's instead of being out in the peripheries or even in that you know main produce aisle where you know those types of people would shop, it forces you into the middle of the store, and I found that very interesting.
I think so. I think that. Here's rule number six, is better yet, buy food somewhere else other than the supermarket, like the farmer's market or community-supported agriculture. Listen, we're all real busy, but we can do that when we can. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think sometimes you got to go to the supermarket. I have to say, I love Fresh Direct delivers to my house.
Oh, yeah.
And they have, on Fresh Direct, in Jersey City is sort of split up. Like, some neighborhoods get it and some neighborhoods don't. My friend Kate lives in a neighborhood where they deliver across the street but not to her house. And she calls them up begging. She's like, your truck is parked in front of my house. Why would you deliver to me? But on Sunday morning at 7 o'clock in the morning, Fresh Direct shows up. And they have an organic section and a local section where I can buy from local preparers. I love it. Here's a great rule. And this is going to sound somewhat snooty, but it's not. Pay more, eat less.
Yes.
Now, most of us are too fat because we eat too much food. And by the way, all the fad diets in the world, you ready? You know why you're fat? Because you eat too much and you don't exercise enough. Okay?
And if you're paying a dollar for six nuggets, for six chicken nuggets, it's probably not a lot of chicken in those. Or
the chicken is they got to do something to the food
right. To
get it to you that cheap. And what they have to do, you don't want in your body.
Right.
So the rule here from Michael Pollan, pay more and eat less. I mean, you know, they say that the American food budget, we used to spend, the middle-class Americans, up until the 1970s, used to spend 50% of our food budget.
50% of our budget.
I'm sorry, 50% of our household budget on food. Now we spend 9 or 10% of our budget on food in the middle class. Well, there's a reason that it costs so little, because there's bad stuff going in there. And
not
bad
just that.
Things are
happening. I mean, there's also corn subsidies. There's a million reasons why our food is cheaper than it should be.
But corn subsidies produce high fructose corn syrup, which goes in your food, which makes it cheap, which isn't good for you, which isn't the same. So again, omnivore solution number 8 is eat a wide diversity of species. Omnivore solution number 9 is eat food from animals that eat grass, not grains and
grass-fed, even beef or bison. Some of the healthiest meats you can possibly eat come from grass-fed animals.
Want to get through the last couple because I like them. One rule number 10 is cook if you can and grow some of your own food if you can. Cooking is food for the soul.
It makes better meals, and if you can grow your own food, it's fun, it's exciting, and it tastes better.
Rule number 11, I love this one, eat meals and eat them only at tables. Not in your car, not walking down the street.
Not even at a counter.
I love it. And then finally, rule number 12, the omnivore solution. We're plugging here Michael Pollan's new book, In Defense of Food. And rule number 12 is eat deliberately with other people whenever possible and always with pleasure.
Excellent set of rules. I have to go back to 11 for one second. Eat meals only at tables. That does not count those little square tables with the orange swivel chairs.
Yes, and
we're
and
not talking about those particular tables.
And I would go a little bit further. Any table that is permanently bolted to the floor and cannot be moved also doesn't count.
Those are the tables that I was talking about.
I call that a counter. All right, we're going to come back and talk with Gail Green, one of our favorite food writers, right after these messages. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Gail Green. Gail's one of the most influential critics in the history of American dining. Her insatiable critic column for New York Magazine continues to make history, and her website, theinsatiablecritic.com, is her current incarnation. We're here to talk about that today.
Hey, Gail, welcome back to the show.
Well, it's great to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise. Now,
2008.
I know, it's crazy.
What will we be eating?
Well, that's why we had you on the show, so you could tell us in 2008.
This is my 40th year as a restaurant critic.
Really? It was 1968?
New York Magazine's 40th anniversary coming up in April.
So it was 1968 when you started reviewing
restaurants?
Wow. Quite a run.
Have they changed it all?
Everything has changed.
Well, so, but
except
you,
me, of course.
Well, no, but that's not true because you keep up with the times. You have your own website, insatiable-critic.com, which is witty and fun and interesting, and for the true foodie is a must go to.
Oh, thank you.
So, what's with the website? What is your goal with the website?
Well, I started it because just having a small column in New York Magazine after I had asked to stop being the weekly critic was just not often enough for me, and I thought I miss having the last word. I miss having, you know, a word on everything that happens. And so I thought the website would be great to, you know, review restaurants. Maybe I have the first word rather than the last word. I try to be the first word. And also it would be good for my book, my memoir, Insatiable. Well, we didn't get online until a year after Insatiable had been published. But we still have part of Insatiable on audio on the site. And the basic focus, of course, is food, mostly eating in New York. But we have a big travel section with hot addresses of places I love in Buenos Aires. We just posted a little short hot tips in Miami Beach by a woman who started writing for the site. I think it's more of a magazine than a blog.
Well, let me talk about that for a second. You wrote for a long time for New York Magazine, and you were the most in that column. New York Magazine was one of the most influential food columns in New York, and therefore in the country. And that's a print publication. Now, this is a very new thing for you. It's what your site is what we call, you know, it's a very rich site. It has a lot of features. It's very current. How do you find writing on the web different than writing for print?
Well, I'm writing every single minute of the day. One of the ways to boost traffic is to change your postings constantly. And although I'm pretty much by myself, I'm competing with Grub Street, New York Magazine's website, where I'm also appearing as the Insatiable Critic because they run my columns.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm competing with them and with Eater and Chowhound, and I assume they all have staffs and people to back them up and editors to check their typos and tech people to fix it when it falls apart. So it seems like I've never worked so hard in my life.
You know, Gail, I have friends who keep blogs, either their political blogs or their food blogs, and they write every day, twice a day. And some people,
or more. I have friends who are even writing more. They're going back to that blog all day long.
Well, and I have friends, and many, and several professionals who work for us suggested that we have a restaurant blog, and some businesses do. I just couldn't possibly keep up with it. I mean,
it's constant. You can't really do anything else. You can hardly go out to dinner.
Yeah, exactly.
I do stop at 5 o'clock, but you spend all day looking for a hot item or a gossip item, something funny that nobody else has written yet. Grub Street, New York Magazine site, I believe they're posting 8 to 12 times a day.
My God.
They put up a new item. And that's what brings people back. My question is, what people are going back, and how do they have the time to be checking websites all day?
Well, I mean, even to read it seems like a ton of work. I mean, I guess I'm kind of old school. I'll go and look at a site when I want to go out to dinner. But I have a number of friends who are on eGullet, which is a wonderful and rich website that I've gone on and I'll read through a week's worth of postings.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll think, my God, who has time to read this all the time? You know, but it's fascinating stuff, but it's a glut of information.
Well, I think you either have a website or you read them. I don't think you could do both.
Now, do you find that your website is interactive? Do you get a lot of email from folks in your website?
I'm getting a lot of email and some questions. Every once in a while I get a question and I have to go out and find the answer. One of the regular visitors to the site wanted to know if liquid nitrogen was harmful when it was used on your food. So I went to Henry McGee to get the answer and made two new friends.
So what's the answer? You can't just leave us hanging like that.
What are you breathing? Nitrogen is in the air.
Sure. Right.
And you breathe it constantly, and once it's used to freeze food quickly, it evaporates into a gas and is not harmful. I hope she's reassured. But basically what I wanted to do was to get people who love food who want to know what's new and happening and worth going to in New York City, who would be people that spend a lot of money on travel and want to know where to eat when they're in Venice or Sicily or Vietnam, you know, the places that I've already posted. Those are the people that I thought were the viewers for my site.
Well,
as you said, they would come on when they want some information.
Well, you know what? We're going to take a quick break, Ellen. I want to come back and talk about your perspective and your current postings on the site. Talk a lot about what to expect in 2008, and I think that there is no more voice that should be listened to. There's not a voice that should be listened to more than yours on that very topic. So we'll be back in just a moment with Gail Green. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagut and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants. We're talking today with Gail Green of New York Magazine and her wonderful website, insatiable-critic.com. And we're talking about, or we're about to talk about, the trends of 08, and after the news we'll continue on with this. But I want to ask you about one thing specific in this very short segment we have before the news, Gail.
Yes.
Are we finally done with big, huge, monstrous warehouse-sized restaurants down in the Meatpacking District? Are we going back to smaller restaurants?
Well, I think that some of those huge restaurants are still being built. But at the moment, everyone is talking about doing something that isn't quite so expensive. And I did have a friend who was about to open one of the most expensive restaurants in New York, and he decided, given the state of the economy, he would just postpone it and do good for the community. So he's now delivering meals for city meals.
Really nice.
And he's very sad not to be opening this incredibly extravagant restaurant concept that he had.
Does he have an idea about how long he thinks he'll have to wait?
Well, he's predicting a recession. You know, I hate to read those articles predicting an actual recession, but I've been through two or three serious recessions as a restaurant critic, and what happens is everyone does start talking bistro, trattoria. Mm-hmm. Now it's tapas. They're opening in
small
little
place.
Teeny counter spaces, and you wonder how they can make a living in a space so tiny.
So is his plan to open 12 little restaurants in his large
space?
No,
he won't give up on his great scheme. He's just postponed it.
You know, we're going to take a break for the news, but when we come back, I want to talk about, I have a theory about restaurants, and I'm wondering if when we see people change over to look for that bistro comfort food, if that's a predictor of a recession or a reaction to a recession. Let's see.
Good question.
We'll flesh that out after the news. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
We're talking with Gail Green, the Insatiable Critic column for New York Magazine, is a historic and very prominent column. She still writes for New York Magazine. Her book, her most recent book, is Insatiable: Tales from a Life of Delicious Excess. and her website is insatiable-critic.com. We were talking, and those of us in the restaurant business hate to talk about recessions, but we were talking about the possibility of a recession. And, Gail, you've lived through a couple of recessions as an important restaurant critic. We lived through one pretty serious one from, like, 89 to 92 in the restaurant business. We didn't have our own place back then. But there is a real turn in tastes when a recession is looming or possibly looming. I remember in the 80s, my impression of it, and I want to ask you yours, of the 80s was up until about 87, we were looking at very high food and literally altitude food stacked high on a plate and sort of a renaissance of American dining. It was a little, there was an exuberance to the American dining. And then after the stock market tumbled in 87, the focus of new restaurants was all bistros, comfort food, meatloaf kind of places. Is there a connection there with the psyche of the nation more than just the budget of the nation?
Well, I certainly don't think that the rush for comfort food is a predictor of disaster. I think it's more a reaction. We've always had restaurants that had great burgers and wonderful macaroni and cheese and other places where you could stop by after the movies and have a modest dinner or supper. But to actually start opening restaurants and promoting and the feel of comfort food and emphasizing brasserie, I think it's definitely a response to suddenly you have $5,000 less in your portfolio or $100,000, or you've lost a job that was paying you $200,000 a year and you can't pay your children's private school bill, which is something that happens in New York a lot. In a recession, a lot of people went into business when they lost extraordinary jobs during that last recession, and out of that grew some of very successful entrepreneurs. Maybe like yourself, when you got into business.
That's true. Interesting.
So a lot of restaurants that are very high end, let's say Le Bernardin, what will they do if the restaurant is only 2/3 full or half full at lunch? Because people are economizing and businesses are not letting their employees pay for business lunches.
Mm-hmm.
They have to maybe have an a la carte menu and put in some items that are less.
Is there maybe also some guilt, you think, for people who can still afford to go out to those restaurants to kind of be overindulging in a time where the economy is not doing that well?
I would say that we have lost all sense of guilt about being rich. People don't seem to be guilty at all.
No.
They just want to know, is it bad for my children if I take a private jet? Are they going to be spoiled?
Yes is the answer.
And besides, why take a private jet? Just charter.
The whole thing about being rich, people have no shame about how rich they are.
And that's different than
I can see.
And that's different than it was 20 years ago, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, you would sort of exaggerate your middle classness when you were already, on the way up.
I'll tell you, I think even if we do go in a recession, and I'm glad you said what you said because I feel exactly the same way, even if we do go in a recession, there will still be a faction of people who will unabashedly go out and spend crazy amounts of money wherever they go.
Well, I mean, it's crazy to you and me, but it's not crazy. If they go from being worth $50 million to being worth $30 million, it doesn't really affect what you're going to order for dinner that night.
Right.
But, I think it does. And Gail, I'm curious to see if you agree with me. And
people feel poor, even when they're not really poor, when the headlines are full of people going in bankruptcy and people losing their homes. I think people do start feeling poor who are not threatened at all.
Well, I think that there is there's a great connection with what kind of foods we crave to how we're feeling, and I think when there's a general feeling of anxiety and uncertainty, there is a comfort in comfort food. That where there is a comfort,
totally.
In,
I totally agree.
Spaghetti and meatballs.
If you have just lost half of your savings, do you want to go out and eat three little tidbits of lamb with some figs and a exotic pepper sauce?
Well, I do, but I don't.
Or do you want like a huge amount of incredible macaroni and cheese?
I don't know. I always want to eat out that way, Gail. So do you. I know it. But
actually, Gail, I probably want a huge amount of macaroni and cheese. Truth be told,
I am just out of control about macaroni and cheese. I don't seem to have any able to judge it, well, even when it's not so good.
All right. Well, let's talk about your website. You have some sort of humorous predictions for the coming year on your website, and everyone should go check it out because it's a lot of fun.
Well, I was reading everybody else's predictions for food trends, serious. And I thought, well, you know, what is going to happen? And I think one of the things that's going to happen is that all these children who are addicted to watching the Food Network,
mm-hmm.
they're going to be cooking. And out of them, of those masses of cooking children, will come one that is so talented that one of New York's big restaurant magnates will hire him and start a restaurant.
Run by a 9-year-old executive chef?
Yes, and there will be no special menus for adults.
my favorite,
pancakes with smiley faces. Here we go.
My favorite of your tongue-in-cheek predictions is that conceptual dining will become the rage. The pleasure will be derived from the dish will be found in the description alone. There is no dish, just a small fee for the description.
Or how about that all smugglers of illegal immigrants have to teach at least one word of English for survival before they release them. The word will be enjoy.
Yeah. Well, now that's a mocking. That's kind of a lot of. There's been a lot of enjoy.
A lot of play.
A lot of enjoy.
There's been a lot of enjoy bashing this year too. I mean,
because it's so annoying. How many times do they have to say enjoy?
Yeah.
And my rules for predictions for 2008. I say each restaurant will be allowed one enjoy per table per evening.
Well, the idea is, of course, if you go to a restaurant and the waiter says enjoy, oh enjoy, and they drop off your club soda and they say enjoy, and you're like, oh, all right, enough with
it's
the
bubbles. Stop
well,
it.
You know what, Frank Bruni in the New York Times wrote a wonderful article where he mentioned that as a litany of complaints, as have a lot of people this year. But there is sort of a weird stilted sort of faux formal speech that waiters can adopt tableside, and we have a lot of young people that work for us, and I often say to them, I'm like, now would you ever say that in the course of conversation? I mean, would you ever speak that way in the course of conversation? Am I right about that, Gail?
Well, how about the waiters that tell you? Do you let them say what their favorite dishes are?
Only if asked. Only if asked.
Well, and also, the one of the worst and most unappealing is, are you still working on that? Are you still cooking on that? I don't understand why restaurants don't train. Even more modest comfort food places should have some kind of idea of what's a proper thing to say.
Because we don't really...
May I clear is a proper thing to say.
We don't really want to accuse our diners of picking at their food, do we?
Well, and working at your food. So I always say, oh, I'm not working. And then my guy says, well, what are you doing? Aren't you writing? Aren't you working?
Well, you know, it's funny, because Gail Green, you are working.
You actually are
food.
Working on your
I
food.
Know,
but the rest of us
aren't. It feels like work to me.
Well, you know, but you know what's interesting is about that speech, that sort of restaurant speak, you know, I think what it comes from is people who don't often speak formally, who are then put in a situation where they want to speak more formally, they want to show a little more respect, and so they want things come out of their mouth like, what would the gentleman care to enjoy this evening? And you're like, what are you, the Duke of Burgundy? What are you talking to? You're in a bad movie. You know, just speak like a human, you know. That's,
well, good. At least you're spreading some good gospel there.
Some common sense. My big line is, will you listen to yourself? Just listen to yourself. Okay, so real food trends, not tongue-in-cheek for 2008. What are some predictions?
Well, as saying, I would say small plates continue, although it's pretty shocking to me that somebody, three or four-star chef like Gray Kunz in New York City would be opening a giant restaurant, cost him a fortune, and he's selling small plates. But people do like the idea of having a couple of dishes and a glass of wine, and that's another way to economize and then to eat less when you're trying to eat less.
You know what I think? I think though that those small plates, I think they work more in a big city than they do out in the suburbs.
Francis and I were actually talking about this.
People still want to see a good portion.
Well, because in the city, I think when you go someplace for small plates, you then go someplace else and have some more small plates.
Well, that's true, and also in the city, people are eating out about four or five or six nights a week.
Yeah, well, and if you're in Bernardsville, even if you're eating out a few nights a week, you go to the small place in Bernardsville, New Jersey, you're not going to get in your car and drive 45 minutes to another place and stop for a cocktail. It's I think people outside of major cities tend to go to one place, go there for the evening, and then go home. And I think it's different in Manhattan, isn't it? Even among people of all ages.
And what about? I think Manhattan is like a slice of. attached to America, totally independent state attached to America. And I always say to people, when you're visiting New York, you've got to go somewhere else, too, to see what America is like.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, we can take a quick break. We'll come right back. We'll talk more with Gail Green of The Insatiable Critic and of her website, insatiable.critic.com, back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC, it's 1145.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, and we're here with Gail Green talking about trends of 2008. You know, Gail, there's a trend.
Oh, sorry.
There's a trend that's sort of crept up over the course of the last couple of years, and I see it more and more. It's with some of these casual places. One of the policies they have, there are many places with a no reservations policy now, or a secret telephone number reservations policy if you can get it, but for most of us, a no reservations policy. Do you see that more and more, and how do you feel about it?
Oh, I hate it.
Oh,
I hate it, and I don't really want to get in a taxi in New York. We have to drive sometimes $20 worth to get down to a hot new place on the Lower East Side. And you don't want to arrive and stand and wait for 40 minutes.
Don't you feel...
Or stand on a line out front and just, you know, wait to get into the place. I don't know. Maybe I'm an old fuddy-duddy, and I don't want to do that.
Oh, you are.
I don't want to do it. Yeah, I am an old fuddy-duddy, and I don't want to do it. I always say something when someone says no reservations on the phone. I say, I think you're making a big mistake. Goodbye.
Well, you know what's funny is I understand, especially if you're trying to scale back and maximize your seats, if you can create that buzz and there's always someone at the door, you can seat many more people in the course of an evening than if, you know, someone has a reservation, they no-show on you.
They're 20 minutes late.
Or you know, someone gets up early and you have that table empty for 15 minutes because you know someone's coming in 15 minutes from now. But I have to say, look, we know a lot of people, so I just don't do it. I mean, if I can call and get myself in the door and get myself on a list or get myself in the back door, I'll go. But I have to say, standing outside on a line, you know, I really wanted to go to Chickalicious Dessert Bar. My fiance has gone there a number of times, and it sounds wonderful. But I just feel stupid standing on the street waiting 15 or 20 or 30 minutes outside so I can get in someplace and have some dessert.
Rather go someplace. There's so many wonderful places and exciting places, new, that you want to try, that do take reservations. It's interesting. The other night we called a place called Solex on the Lower East Side,
mm-hmm.
and they said, we don't take reservations. And my friend said, you know, we have to come a long, long way. And he said, oh, all right, let me hold a table for you. And it was just charming and sweet with a great French accent. And we arrived, and there was our tall table with tall chairs reserved. And we sat down and had incredible French food made by a pastry chef who's doing savories. Almost everything had either a pie crust or wrapped in bread or on a pizzetta dough. It was amazing food. We had enough fat and carbs for 3 weeks.
And what's the name of the place?
It's called Solex.
Huh. We'll stick that up on our website as well, a tip from Gail Green.
Oh, I love it. That it's one of the, it's the restaurant I reviewed this week in my journal, Bite.
Mm-hmm.
I led off with Solex because it was just the kind of place I would probably spend $40 round trip to go back again.
You know, the interesting thing, though, on the flip side of things, is the reason restaurateurs are doing this is because restaurateurs are getting killed with no-shows for a long time, or with people who are later, et cetera, et cetera. And if you're running a small place and you're running it close to the bone, it can really be the difference between making a profit or not. So what I don't mind as a trend that I see more and more, and obviously I'm a restaurateur, so we only do this on very busy nights, I don't mind giving a credit card to hold a reservation. I have no, especially in the face of so many restaurants that are arising that don't take reservations. I want to say, listen, I'll give you $50
right.
if I don't show up. Just hold me a table. What do you think about taking credit cards with reservations?
I think that some people are annoyed when asked to reserve with a credit card, but I can understand it. And I think for a restaurant that every seat is precious. And Saturday night, often people will make reservations in three or four places and then decide where they want to go and not bother to cancel. Oh. I think it does protect you. And if I was a serious restaurant goer and intending to come there, I would not at all mind.
I will tell you that one of the great things about owning two restaurants now in the same town and using one central reservation office is occasionally people who don't know that the two restaurants are affiliated will call and make a reservation at one. And then 3 minutes later, call and make a reservation at the other one.
Oh, caught.
And we're like, hey!
I think one of the things that's happening, is going to continue to happen, is wine bars.
Mm-hmm.
And wine bars suggest you can eat as much or as little as you want. You're going to find wonderful wine or decent wine by the glass. The only problem is we probably are not going to reserve a seat for you, but the turnover will be relatively fast, faster than a restaurant. And I see that happening in large spaces, like we have a restaurant called Academia di Vino on 3rd Avenue.
Sure.
They do take reservations, and those restaurants are not just serving small plates. They are serving tiny plates, medium plates, pizzas, main courses, pastas. You know, it's one of those things of eat whatever you're in the mood to eat. And I think that's how people do want to eat. And when they're stressed, they especially want to eat that way. They don't want to dress. They don't want to spend a lot of money. And they would love to just have a little of this and a little of that. And it might be two appetizers and a dessert for four people to share.
Gail, 30 seconds. Number one restaurant that is new in New York that people need to hit. What is it?
Well, I love BLT Market in the Ritz-Carlton on Central Park South. Wonderful food by Laurent Tournadal. I do love a new restaurant called Boca de Baco, which is a wine bar on 9th Avenue. Very modest, charming. You feel like you could be in Italy. It's just bare brick and Italian-speaking waiters.
Well, and there we have it, the tips from Gail Green for 2008. Hop on your galoshes and go out and check out the new places. Gail, thanks so much for spending the time.
Gail, we'll talk again soon.
It was great to talk to you again. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. That's Gail Green from insatiable-critic.com. You can check it out yourself. We'll link it from our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Back in just a moment, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:56.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, the stage left in Catherine Lombardi, talking with you.
Gail was talking about wine bars and places like that that have kind of grown in New York City. I think across the country, one of the other trends that we've seen, even in places that where those types of places haven't popped up, you've seen a lot of places convert parts of their restaurant to a bar menu or a bar theme or convert their bar room into that type of place where you can get small plates or you can just have a glass of wine or maybe go from place to place more readily than sitting in the main dining room and having a full meal.
I think the bar menu in restaurants is important. I think people are longing for an ability to stop into a place and say hello. And look, the newspapers are full of people predicting the death of the entree and the death of the white linen tablecloth in favor of more casual environments. I think that's overblown. But I do think that people are looking to incorporate back into their lives adult places to go. And it's stopping for a beer or a glass of wine and something on the way home and not making an evening of it, or going to the movies, or just going out for an hour and heading back home. And I think that's a great thing, and that's why, you know, you see our emphasis. I think that's hand-in-hand with the new emphasis on cocktails.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And I think it's a good thing. I think it's a really good thing. And I think that's why you're seeing a resurgence in cities a lot, because people want a sense of community that's not just centered around the PTA and the kids in the school.
Or and the a television big special, set.
Or a big special night out where you have to get a sitter for the whole night. It's like, hey, let's go grab a quick something on the way home. And people have incorporated the local tavern or the local restaurant into their lifestyle, and I think that's a good thing, because I think we need adult company, and that's what a community is based on, adults coming together and having conversations.
Well, adult company that isn't a box talking at you is people
right. an actual human. Well, anyway, I hope that you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC, the time is 12 noon.